Okay, so I want to say a little bit about the overall, what we're doing in the course, what we're trying to explore in the course a bit more. I want to say a little bit about the first stage of the course, and then I want to suggest some home practice for you. Yes, every week there'll be home practice. What I'm going to be doing is drawing out some of the practice that I'm suggesting in the book. Rather than try and get you to do everything, which is you do too much. What's probably best as a rule of thumb is to do a bit less than you think you can manage, but do that. Yeah? So I'll try and keep the home practice part of it fairly minimal, if I can manage it. Even if I don't, see if you can do, try and choose something you can do that you can actually do for the whole week, so that next week, when we come back and we have our home groups again, you can say what you did and say how you got on, yeah? So generally, I think it's better to take on a bit less than you can manage so that you can manage that. So if you think I could do all of those three or four things, then just do two of those things and see if you can do them for the whole time, yeah? Okay, let's just first of all say what the shape of the course is. Just to give you a sense of where we're going. So what we're going to be doing in these next 8 weeks is exploring these five great stages of life, five great stages of human flourishing. I keep on trying to find different words because I don't like spiritual life. I'm trying to get rid of that word altogether. Not life, spiritual. I don't know what it means sometimes. So how I've thought about it is that surely the issue for all of us, for you and me, is how to make the most of our life. That seems to me a very simple way of saying it, doesn't it? That all of us want to make the most of our life. I do, and you do. From a Buddhist point of view, this figure represents the most you can make of your life. Yeah. Whether you relate to this figure or not isn't so important, but he represents, he's not even a he particularly. This figure has gone beyond any kind of identification with his biological gender in his case. So it's only a he, even in a provisional way. But he represents the most you can make of life. And you can see why, when you think of it like that, that's why he's sitting on a lotus. He's sitting on a moon mat. He's supposed to be sitting on the full moon. He's gold in colour. He represents the most we can make of our life. What's stranger is that he represents what we really want, even though, you know, from a Buddhist point of view, even though you might not picture it like that. He represents our need to fully be, fully live, fully exist in this life. In one of my books, I said that there's something about us that we're like dry seeds yearning to be flowers, that we don't ever feel complete, finally finalized until we completely flower. That's what we're like. We want to completely express our nature. And that complete expression of our nature looks a bit like that. Yeah. So it's a bit like, you know, a blade of grass wants to really be a blade of grass. It completely expresses its nature. It is quintessentially, irrepeatably, is that a word? Anyway, it wants to. Just be completely be a blade of grass. We want to be completely a human all the time. We want to be completely fulfilled all the time. I've been thinking that we human beings are strange, ambitious creatures who want to have the whole of life all the time, who want to live in the best possible place all the time. And of course, everybody knows this, the market knows this, and it tries to say, Yes, you do want that, so I'll sell you something and that will make you feel like that. Nearly all advertising really is based on the mental state you'll get if you get this car, this girlfriend, this iPod shuffle, this holiday in Marbella, this, you know, fur coat, this diamond ring, this whatever. It's all really trying to say, you know, you want this incredible life. Actually, what you really want to be is a pop star, or you want to be that football player. What's his name?
Rooney.
Possibly. There's an element of doubt creeping in already. No, the other one.
Beckham. You know,
Beckham, that's right. Yeah, he does, yeah. The usual denial with covers of reality, yeah. So do you see that the market wants to say, yes, you do want to lead this incredible life, and that really means being in Hello magazine, it means being successful and so on. And most of us, some of us, have tried to pursue success. Even I've tried to pursue success in my own small way, and look at me, I'm a wreck. I'm an object of pity. Success never works. There's something, however much success you get, it's never quite enough. However much money you get, it's never quite enough. As soon as you get finally buy the house of your dreams, there's always one room less. You always think, it would just be great, we could do with a conservatory. There's always something that doesn't quite do it. It's not that we're bad or wrong or sort of, you know, sinful consumers. We really are trying to make the most of life. We don't know, haven't a clue how to do that. So a conservatory, a house, a career in publishing, in my case, publishing a poem, you know, you think, well, that's going to make me feel like a someone. I remember when I first went to this poetry workshop, I was thinking, what am I really trying to achieve on the negative side with writing? And it was to be someone. And you see, when someone's a celebrity, not that you could ever happen in that could ever happen in poetry, but anyway, let's worry about that. You know, if you were Grace Jones or something, everywhere you go, just to give you a contempt show that I'm up with. Actually, she's not that contemporary. Anyway, yeah. So I'll try and think of a more modern. I must look at the anyway. Everywhere she goes, whoever the contemporary version of Grace Jones is, male or female, people will photograph you and stand to look at you and so on. So you can't help thinking that would make you feel real. That will make you feel really substantial. That would make you feel like a someone. But it always evades you. But that instinct to fully blossom, to fully flourish, is you can't get rid of it. We all of us have it. It both makes us happy and unhappy. It's both a torment and a gift. We all want to live everything now. We're incredibly ambitious. And you see that all the marketing does is it uses that very deep urge we all have and tries to sell you things so that you'll get that. It's actually lying to you. We're being lied to all the time. It's saying that you'll get it by doing this. And you're sort of often, or I'm often, lying to myself, thinking, yes, this will do it, even though I know it doesn't. We're all in that situation, whether you've been practicing Buddhism like I have for many years or whether you just come tonight. But you see that this image, I didn't mean to say any of this, the image on the shrine represents that urge we have, as it were, to fully succeed, to really be someone. That urge translated to the highest pitch, yeah, you know, it represents majesty, it represents an incredible calm, incredible beauty, steadfastness. You know, you could almost just read off the qualities of the Buddha just by looking at the image. So my wager for this course is that that's what you want. Even if you don't call it that, even if you use different words, that's what you want and that's what I want. Buddhism is, what we call Buddhism, is a whole set of teachings, metaphors, advice, practices, stories, lifestyles, behaviours that move you towards that most, that move you, that try to take that urge you've got, which makes you want to be in Hello Magazine or go to Marbella or whatever it is, take that urge you've got, not pejoratize it, not make a problem of it, but channel it so as to meet your real good, if you see what I mean, so that you flourish the most. So then my whole idea for this book and this course is, how do we make the most of our life? This figure represents the most we can make of our life. Whether you relate to it or not isn't that important at the moment. So that our journey in life is going from less to more and from more to most. That's what we're trying to do on this course. So the first stage of that I'm going to be talking about in a minute is integration, coming first of all, taking ownership of our life, and that's the main thing I want to talk about just now. But I want to just explore just a little bit more the elements of making the most of your life. It's such an easy phrase. I only happened upon it because someone said, when I just finished the book, they sent me the blurb, and they said, oh, we need a first line for the blurb. And I was very busy that day, and I just wrote down, how can we make the most of our life? And I just sort of happened upon it. I thought, oh, yes, that's about it, really. It's very, very ordinary language, but that's about it. So one of the things, as soon as I think about how to make most of my life, an absolute essential part of that is knowing that it's going to end, isn't it? That's what really provokes that question, is that we know it's going to end, that we know our life is going to end, and we don't know when. So the one thing most sure, as Buddhism says, is you're going to die, and the one thing least sure is when it's going to happen. So it's that fact that makes us want to make the most of our life, because it's short. I mean, I'm 54 now. I'm amazed that I got to 54 in some ways, and I'm amazed how quickly it goes. I remember the difficult birthday for me was 40, where you couldn't have a 30-something in your age. I'm 32, 3. Even getting to 39, you've still got that word, lovely word, 30. Then suddenly you've got, click, 40. And I really found it difficult. And then it's just been a little, really quick slope down to 50. So what happened to 10 years? That's what happens. As you get older, time goes faster. As you get older, if you don't start working on your mind now, you'll get more and more set in your ways. It's very, very easy to do that. If you don't start working with your mind, you will become set in your ways. Your mental habits will get more and more set. I'm afraid. I mean, that's assuming that they're all bad, your mental habits, and they won't be. Some of them will be good mental habits, but some of them will be bad ones, won't they? And they'll get more and more habitual if you don't work with your mind. So it's quite a dangerous position we're in, because we know that we're going to die. We don't know when. So that makes us think, how am I going to make the most of my life? I've been really struck by suddenly it's winter. It seemed to be summer this morning, and then suddenly you can feel the cold in the air and the streets full of leaves. And it's such a cliche, it's such a banality. Sometimes, this first time you feel the cold in the air, you think, oh my, we're already there already. And then in England, of course, you've got 6 months of it at least to look forward to. So the first thing about making the most of our life is that we know it's going to end and we don't know when. That means asking the question, so what's really important to do? All of us are being bombarded by more and more things to do. Email. I mean, I just seem to have emails for the rest of my life, as I'm sure you do. So often I feel that there are just too many things to do in my life. And I'm a nice Buddhist person. I live in a Buddhist centre. But most people are like that, aren't they? And you see how very often that crowds out the question of, okay, what's the priority? What did I mean to do with my day? Did I mean it just to sort of disappear in a sort of flash of emails and websites and trawling through Facebook pages? Or did I mean to actually have a day that I lived? You know? There's a lot to try to do that. So how do we what do we prioritise? It also suggests, well, what is our vision of life and death? One of the things I want to do on this course is emphasise that given that we're going to die and we don't know when, given that that means I want to make the most of my life, that means what does that mean? What are my priorities? And what vision do I bring to bear on my life? What does my life mean? Almost metaphysically, it's a bit unfashionable now, metaphysics, but what is it? Why are we here? Interestingly, children often feel this, don't they? I remember as a child just thinking, yes, but like, what's it for? And I even when I was a child, I couldn't even, you know, frame the question. But I particularly when I remember my grandmother dying and my mother saying, you know, she's gone to a better place and she's asleep and all that sort of thing, I was thinking, no, she's definitely not here anymore. So what are we doing? What are we doing? And I even then sensed that my parents didn't know. And my parents, actually, bless them, didn't have time to know because they had to work so hard. All they could do was feed a large family and run a very poor, failing business. I sometimes think that we're living off incredible indebtedness to our parents. So often our parents have had to work so hard. And most people in the world have to work so hard they don't have time to ask metaphysical questions. It's a luxury, really. Yes, but for me, the question right from a child was, so what are we doing? So why are we doing? What is life? What is death? What are we here for? Those kind of large questions. I still believe that those are central questions to every sphere of human life, whether it's the arts, whether it's meditation, friendship, work, play, travel. The big question is, so why are we here? What are we doing? What's it for? What's my life for? What's its meaning? Because we think, you know, we know we're going to, we know life is going to end in death, but we've no idea what death is. We think we know what it is, but we don't know what it is. All we have is beliefs about death. I don't know what it is, and you don't know what it is. I know what Buddhism says, and you might know what, I don't know, secular humanism says, it's the end, but none of us actually know what death is. So we need some kind of deeper vision of life. So what I've tried to do in these 8 weeks is explore a deeper vision of life, and explore explicitly a Buddhist vision of life. When I first wrote the book, I thought what I'd like was to create a book. Because some people often think, am I a Buddhist or not? Am I a Buddhist? And then, no, you know. So I wanted to write a book that you could do the book and then at the end decide whether you're a Buddhist or not. Yeah. But you don't need to do it for that reason. But that was one of my ideas. So those are all of those elements of how do I make the most of my life. That death is going to happen. We don't know when. That means, what am I doing here? What are my priorities? What's really important? How do I live honourably and humanly in the face of my own death, but also in the face of terrible suffering around me? I mean, I'm sure we're all very struck, you know, struck, confused, moved, worried, whatever, about you know, this huge movement of people, this incredible movement of people. Someone was saying that there's 6,000 people a day going into Italy. To imagine us walking across, I don't know, having to walk up to Scotland and get a boat out to Iceland, you know, are quite unthinkable. And they're just people like us, people who could have come to this class. How do we live in that world? It seems to me like horribly divided in a way that I don't know what to do about. My grandmother used to cry every time she watched the news, and I've almost arrived at that place. So what we're trying to do here at the London Buddhist Centre and on this course, completely impossible though that sounds, and I didn't actually mean to quite start in the batting quite as hard as this, but anyway, I meant to be a bit more like kind of nice and like funny. But I don't seem to be in that mood. So deal with it. I have to every day. You only have to do it once a week. Think yourself lucky. You know, the impossible thing we're saying is, okay, let's really think about our life and how do we make the most of our life, given the life that we lead that's going to end in death and given the world we're in, not some other fantasy world. Yeah? And the Buddhist answers to those questions isn't an answer in words, because you can't answer it in words. It has to be lived out. That answer has to be discovered by living it, by practicing an answer, by discovering an answer, and by living on the basis of that answer more and more. And that answer is to be found in this movement of from less to more and from more to most. If nothing else, this figure is a figure of compassion, universal compassion. And that the Buddha, when he became a Buddha, all there was love. This figure is also a figure where there's nothing else, in effect, but love and wisdom. That's all there is. There's no ego. There's no self anymore. There's no referencing everything back to me and my likes and dislikes, and my life and my few friends and my family. All of that's gone for the Buddha. There's just love. Yeah, there's just wisdom. So these five stages are stages towards that goal. So my subtitle is A Practical Course in Enlightenment. So if you gain enlightenment by the end of the 8 weeks, you're going to lead the next one, okay? and I'm going to sit in the audience and listen to you. So that'd be nice. So do tell me if you have gained enlightenment at the I can retire from public life. Paint watercolours. So the first stage of that journey, of these great phases, is, and none of these titles for these stages are very good, they sort of have pros and cons, but I'm calling this first stage, integration. So the first thing that we're trying to do, first thing that we need to do to make the most of our life is integrate ourselves, is become one person, is take full ownership of our life. Yeah, that's how I've been thinking about it. Take full ownership of life. Live completely from our own being, you know, our own resources, our own vision, our own aims, our own ideals, rather than living just the beck and call of all the pressures around us. I've been thinking that if we don't do this, we make ourselves particularly prey to the marketplace. I mean, the main part of the marketplace that I'm particularly prey to is Amazon. I should have one of those screen filters that stops you going onto Amazon. But if you're not integrated, if you're not owning your life, you're particularly prey to all the pressures now coming into your smartphone, into your hand, to buy something, to download something, to live at other people's beck and call in one way or another. Not to live a life that you've decided to live, but just because you haven't decided yet, to give your initiative over to the forces around you. So integration is about taking ownership of your life. You could say, I mean, I talked a lot about it in the book, and so do, as I say, read that chapter in the week coming. But the simplest way is to talk about taking ownership of your life and wholeness. So we're trying to become whole, on one hand, to use a sort of static metaphor, and we're trying to take ownership of our life, by which I mean living our life the way that we have chosen to live it, rather than just going along with whatever happens to happen to us and reacting to that and so on. Yeah. So that's what we're going to be doing these first 2 weeks, is try to cultivate integration, try to become whole, try to gather ourselves up into a whole person, so that we're focused rather than distracted, integrated, unified rather than dissipated and fragmented, so that we live fully in charge of our life. Actually, it's a huge ideal in itself. So easy to just sort of be scattered, fragmented, even divided against ourselves. Very, very commonly. So, you know, that a lot of people have this very harsh inner voice in their mind, criticizing themselves. So that's even dividing against yourself. So never mind being divided against others sometimes, but we divide against ourselves. We have different selves, don't we? So we want to do this, but we actually do that. We mean to do this, but we do something else. The more you become aware of yourself, the more you realise very often that you're not in charge of your life, that you don't really know who's running it. Yeah? So the first great project of making the most of our life is to live an integrated, unified life, rather than a dissipated, distracted, alienated, broken up life. So that's what we're going to be doing this week and next week, and then we're going to move on to stages beyond that. So I'd like you in the week to read about this stage of integration. There's a lot to say about it. I'm trying to think how much more I need to say just now, but there's a lot to say about it. The first thing I want to do, the main thing I want to do just now, though, is start to give you practices to cultivate integration. Theory is fairly easy. Recently I was teaching this, something like this, to a group of lawyers, and I did a presentation, and someone said, yeah, it sounds great, but how do you do it? You know, in other words, I've been at lots of presentations that sound great. You know, show me how you do it and I'll tell you whether it actually works. Everything sounds great. So I want to say a little bit about how we do it, and then I want to say about how I'd like you to do it this week. And then we'll carry on a bit more with this next time. So, two main things I want to emphasise is an internal practice of integration and an external practice of integration. Yeah? I might even follow this as the course goes on. Everything has this internal element, working with the stage internally, and something in your outside life that supports that. You see what I mean? It's not enough just to do it in your mind. It's not enough to do it in the world. You need to do a bit of both, yeah? So what you might do each week is make sure you're doing something of the internal practice and something of the external practice. So in terms of internal practice, the big issue, the big thing I want us to work on is this word prapuncture, which means mental proliferation. It's probably what you've all come with, is a noisy, thinking is too grand a term, noisy, clattering, talkative, dissipating, butterfly kind of mind that hops from one thing to another, worries about this, plans about that, fantasizes about that, runs off in a whole delta of avenues, doesn't it? That's the mind we've got, what we call a busy mind very often. Traditional Zen Buddhists call it a monkey mind, hopping from one thing to another. The Buddhist word for it is prapuncture. As I say, it means mental proliferation. It means driven, associative thinking. Actually, to make it really clear, driven, unaware, associative thinking. Yeah? Driven, unaware, associative thinking. So it's not thinking in the philosophical sense. It's a driven, unaware, associative thinking. So it's driven. You can't stop yourself doing it. It's not that you think, oh, what should I think about? Oh, I know, I'll worry about this, or I'll plan about that, or fantasize about this. You just keep on finding yourself in this river of thought. And it can be like a torrent, can't it? That becomes really, really painful of a loud cacophony of thought. Yeah, and it's driven, it feels driven. And you feel driven when you're in the grips of it, don't you? You feel driven in your mind, you feel your body is being driven by it. You can't relax, you can't settle to things very easily. You then often act out of it. I say you, I mean me as well. You then act out of it, and that creates more driven, unaware thinking. Still more concerningly, it's unaware thinking. So it's often habitual ruminations, habitual whirligig of thought, and it goes on just below the level of awareness. Because it's habitual, because you've thought that sort of stuff a lot, you don't really notice you're thinking about it. This is one of the particular things that you work with depression, is if you're prone to depression, you'll have an automatic tendency, when you're not watching your mind, for your mind to start to drift over into picking up and elaborating on the most negative ways of seeing things, of proliferating self-critical thoughts, proliferating sense of what's wrong with me, why am I not happy. Aberrant problem-solving is a psychological term. But it'll be going on so habitually that you won't notice it's happening. Yeah? So it's unaware thinking. And what else did I say it was? It was driven and associative. So it just runs often from one thing to another.
Yeah.
It might be a success fantasy. It might be the hard high of a sales do. It might be, you know, some sort of harsh critical thought, whatever. But that's the first thing that we need to be working with. Because what that is, those are the forces of disintegration. The more you allow your mind to run down those habitual automatic channels, the more you disintegrate on that basis. You become a different person as your mind goes down all of those channels. And those different people end up in conflict with each other. So the first thing I want you to do this week is really start to notice this unaware, this driven, unaware, associative thinking that's going on just below the level of awareness. Try to notice any patterns, a particular kind of driven, unaware thinking that you get into, and it'll be different for each of us. And see if you can keep on stepping out of that into direct experience of your body. Yeah. Into direct experience of your body. So that's the main thing I want to say internally this week. In a minute I'll suggest two ways, I think, or one way, in which I want you to do that. I'll give you one or two choices to do that. But I want you to do that. That's the internal practice I want you to do this week. Notice unaware, driven, unaware, associative thinking. Step out of it into, yeah, but what's happening in my knee? What's happening with my weight on the chair just now? My knee isn't doing that thinking. My bottom on the chair just now isn't planning about tomorrow. Yeah. That's the internal element. Externally, what I'd like you to do is simplify your life in some way. Yeah. So the external support for integration is simplifying your life. So what can you do this week to simplify your life? I've made various suggestions in the book. So, for instance, I suggested that you reduce input. Is there a way in which you could reduce the bombarding input in your life? So if you go on the tube to work, could you not listen to your, whatever it is you're listening to, and even meditate on the tube? Practice this practice of noticing your mind, coming back to your body and breathing. Noticing your mind going off, that's fine, don't worry about that. Come back to your body and breathing. Do that all the way to work. Try and do that, or something like that. Or it might just be that you think, okay, that's too much. So how about you log off your computer at a certain time every night? Yeah. It might be that you don't check your emails before breakfast. It might be as simple as that. Or you don't check them last thing at night. For some people now, as soon as they wake up, they're bing, boom, that universal bing sound as you turn on your computer, and there's bing, 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 all the little blue dots appearing. So many people are doing that the first thing they do or the last thing they go to bed. So could you, for a week, not do that first thing or not do that last thing? Another way to simplify your life is to cultivate discipline. So you might think, okay, I'm going to have an alcohol-free week. You might think I'm going to have, I'm not going to answer emails on my smartphone for the week. I'm going to do something that sort of disciplines my life a bit more in a way that helps my life go a bit deeper. I'm going to stop, watching mindless television in the, you know, having breakfast television on whilst I'm ironing my shirt or whatever like that. Yeah. But anyway, however you do it, see if you can think of something that simplifies your life. Another thing you can do is do something that you're putting off. That's another way of simplifying your life. Things that you put off are actually complications in your life. So you might just do something like tidy up your room that you've been putting off. Something that you know, again, you can be slightly unaware of it, but somewhere in the back of your mind there's a pressure that you've been putting something off. Perhaps you need to talk to somebody about something. Perhaps you need to sort out your desk at work. Perhaps you need to do something that you've been putting off. Yeah. So all of those are about simplifying your life. Yeah. So that's what I want you to do this week, is work internally on stepping out of propuncture and simplify your life to support that. And that's all part of this first great stage of integration. I also, of course, want you to read the book, at least that part of it. And you can start tonight on the tube. Yes, easy peasy. lemon squeezy. So I've written various ways of practices that you can do to step out of prapuncture. So what you might do is three breathing spaces a day, where you just do a 3-minute breathing space. At the end of tonight, we'll do one, just to get so you know what it is, but I've written about it in the book. Very, very straightforward thing to do. Only takes 3 minutes. So you might decide, I'm going to do three of those a day, and that's how I'm going to work on prapuncture. Yeah? Or you might decide, I'm going to have a mindful meal every day. So I don't fancy doing that breathing space thing, so I'm just going to have a mindful meal every day, where I'm not going to have any music on, but I'm going to use that as this chance to step out of prapuncture into the taste of my Rice Krispies, or whatever it is. I'm going to have a mindful meal every day. Yeah? Might be something like that. Might be a mindful walk or whatever, yeah. And then I want you to decide how you're going to simplify your life. So what I'd like to do now is pair up with just the person next to you, just for now. How are you going to do those? What could you do to step out of prapuncture? So some of you will be meditating already. If you are, is that how you're going to do it? You're going to use that to step out of prapuncture. Try and think of how you're going to do that. Or you're going to do three breathing spaces or a mindfulness meal. What you're going to do, and then how can you simplify your life? Just probably one thing. Don't do too much. So do one of each at least. If you've got enough time, do two of each, but at least do one of each, yeah? And read the book. So let's have just a few minutes to talk about that, and then I want to give you the book.